And I've been able to talk to people who like refuse to talk to anybody else, you know? And I love that. I love that people feel safe with me. I love that people, you know, want to come up to me and ask me things, and that it works. They, like, I'm able to get through to them when nobody else was, like, because they might not ever have had somebody like that if I wasn't around, you know? If I was still on drugs, I mean.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
We're just going to jump right into it.
Jump right in it.
All right. Welcome to the Most High Show, made by and for people in recovery, a show about recovery, spirituality, and being human. Our mission is to provide impactful, community-driven media that informs, empowers, and inspires positive change. Real people, real stories, real life. This is the Most High Show. Close my notes. Joining me in the studio today is a familiar face and a familiar friend. We have Bailey coming back. A previous Most High Media intern, Bailey is now in her dream role of forensic peer support specialist. Not only is she a person in long-term recovery, but she's stayed sober and achieved her goals despite a life-changing cancer diagnosis. Thank you, Bailey, for coming back to the studio tonight to share some of your story and inspiration with us.
Hey, guys. I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it feels right now, like having you back in the studio. Like, there's been some sort of balance restored.
I know. This is home. It will always be home.
Well, how does it feel to be back?
It feels so good. Like, I've come and visited, like, two or three times. And, like, every time I'm so excited, but everyone was so busy. So it's like, and now nobody's here tonight. But
yeah,
well, I mean, like, there's people here. Our friends are here, but like Christian's out, you know, David's not here. You know,
like nobody
people
matters,
have to be
actually.
Family people.
Cool. Well, we can just like, we can cut the cameras now and just go home. Like,
no, they're watching.
Well, let's dive into something not as fun and funny to talk about, but that life-changing diagnosis that you got. So you had shared with me previously before a little bit about the cancer, and you said it's called sarcoma.
Yes.
So what is sarcoma?
Okay. So what I have is actually a synovial sarcoma. There's like 70 plus, different types of sarcomas. And sarcomas is like a soft tissue cancer, but that's like a relative term because it could be in your bones. It could be in your joints. It could be in your soft tissue. It could be in your lungs, you know. It could really be anywhere. And they really don't have any information about it as to what causes it. The only thing that they have not ruled out is injury. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when were you diagnosed with that?
I was diagnosed on my birthday, February 20th, 2024. I had kind of already known. I was admitted. Well, no, not admitted. I went to the ER on January 11th of 2024 for a completely different reason. I have blood clots in my lungs sometimes. I get DVTs. So we thought I was having blood clots. And I went in. I was having trouble breathing for days. And like the symptoms seemed the same. So I had gone in and my mom had just happened to take off work that day and shows up, and I had given up on this. I had this lump on my leg and I was like, don't talk about it. Like, I'm over it. It'd been 4 years of, I don't know what it is. And I was like, I'm so over this. So in a DVT situation, they do an ultrasound of your calf, all the way up into like your thigh area, like hip, to see if that vein, the deep vein thrombosis, like, is blocked in any way. Mm-hmm. And so they were already doing ultrasound when my mom came in and she was like, hey, while you're doing that, do you mind looking at this spot? And I was kind of annoyed, like, no, like, I've already had 9 ultrasounds on this spot. Like, I don't care. And they did it anyway. And like 30 minutes later, the doctor had come in and was like, so you don't have any blood clots, but I know a sarcoma when I see one. And I think you have a sarcoma. And me not knowing what a sarcoma is, and my mom working in a cancer center, she's like, oh, it's nothing. And I'm like, no, like, what's a sarcoma, you know? And he's like, well, you know, you're going to have a biopsy. I'm like, for what, you know? And so, of course, I start Googling. And let me tell you, when you Google sarcoma, it's not pretty, you know? And so I was convinced I was going to die the next day. Yeah. So that's.
He said, you don't have blood clots, just cancer.
Yeah. just cancer. Just
cancer, you know.
Yeah. But honestly, like, I had had so many scans on that one area. And he said, because he was trained in sarcomas, which I now know is a real thing, there is like a special team of people who deal with sarcomas. I have a team who makes all the decisions on me. Like, I can't just go to any oncologist, I can't go to any doctor. Mm-hmm. They all have to be like certified and like, be in contact with the sarcoma board to deal with me. And there's only certain states that like deal with it. So
is that because of the type of sarcoma you have, or is that just it's the like, rarity it just requires... of
sarcomas in general?
Okay.
Yeah. Like one in a million is like 800 people a year get diagnosed with what I have in this entire world.
And so you said that that was a spot on your leg that you'd known about for a while. Mm-hmm. And so how long was that spot there where you just like thought nothing of it?
I thought something of it as soon as I noticed it. They think that because of a tumor having to grow to hit the surface, that I probably had it 2 years before I ever noticed it. I have a friend that a lot of people here in this community know, but he had said that when he met me in 2019, I always talked about this spider bite on my leg, and I don't really remember that, but he's like, I showed him the spot, you know, and he was like, it's that same spot. I remember sitting in jail, and I woke up that morning and my leg hurt and there was a lump on it, and I was like walking around. I was in a cell by myself, so I'm like walking around the cell trying to figure out how I hit my leg in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. And so I went to the nurse and she's like, oh, here's some muscle rub, like you'll be fine. And I was like, but it really hurts. Like, this is weird. Like, this just popped up on my leg and it never went away. It just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I like had been on this journey since from then till years later of like jails, RSATs, you know, everything. So every single time I had gone, I had like asked the doctors and nurses, like, will you look into this? Like, I'm worried about this. And it got to the point where people would be like, what's on your leg? And I'm like, it's just cancer. Like, and I was kind of serious, but I really wasn't, you know, like I didn't know.
Like, you were joking, like, you're like, oh, well, yeah. Everything's cancer. So,
well, I was just like, something's wrong with me, and these people just aren't going to do anything. So, yeah, it's cancer, you know? And like, it's I was casual. Incarcerated, you know? I just knew that like nobody was going to do anything. I had been told that it was a knotted muscle, a blood clot in a spider vein that could not be removed because I would bleed out and die if they like cut the vein and tried to get it out. I had been told that it was a muscle from when I broke my leg in a car accident that it had torn and was dropping. That's kind of what I stuck with at the end. That was probably like 3 to 6 months before I was actually diagnosed that somebody had said that, a nurse had said that to me. And I was like, oh, that makes sense. I'm running with it, you know? Because yeah. Nothing else made sense. Like when I flexed my leg, it clearly had something to do with my muscle because it would like move with my muscle. Mm. And like, I was like, I don't know. It wasn't like a lymphoma. Like, I don't know if anybody watches like Dr. Pimple Pop or anything, but it was
definitely
not like,
not.
Yeah, it was not one of those things. Like it was something inside my leg that would like get bigger based on how I move my leg, you know? And it caused me a lot of pain. Like I hated walking. Like it was horrible. And so, yeah, I mean, it just, I had so many people just tell me like, oh, it's nothing. You're fine. Like we saw the scans. We don't see anything. And I have conspiracies about that, but you know, right.
Like on the After Dark show,
right?
we can get into those. So, okay. So it's, you said 2024.
Yeah.
So at this point, cause your sobriety date is in 2021,
yes,
right? So
September 16th.
Hell yeah. So you are a couple years into recovery and now you know, it's not blood clots. It's potentially cancer. What's going through your head?
Well, like I said, Google was my best friend and I did a lot of Googling, like would go days without sleeping and like calling my mom at like 3 a.m. freaking out because like we have to go, like I'm going to die tomorrow. Like there's this one, I don't remember the name of it, but there's a type of sarcoma. So mine's synovial. This one starts with an R and like you have like a 2% like survival rate. And I was like, that's what I have. And so then I was starting to think like, okay, we're going to do a biopsy and then we have to do a PET scan. Like I knew that was coming. Like they were kind of telling me what the steps were going to be. And so in my head, I'm thinking like, okay, when we do the PET scan, that's to see if there's cancer anywhere else. Well, my stomach hurts every morning when I wake up. You know, my thighs cramp really bad. You know, I'm thinking every single thing is cancer. I'm like, it's everywhere in my body. There's no
You're
way.
You're like the poster child of why you should never Google your
symptoms. Yeah, please, guys, if y'all are listening, don't Google. It will ruin your life. I have really low blood pressure. So a lot of the anxiety medications that like are recovery approved that, you know, when you go to different like places that are like a community service board or something, they give you those. I can't take them. Like I pass out like because my blood pressure is so low.
Well, then you won't be anxious.
Yeah. You
won't. Right.
So I actually did get a Xanax prescription and a lot of people were like, you know, and I gave it to my grandparents and I said, you know, if I'm having an anxiety attack, that's when you give me half of it. You know, like I had to make sure that I was like working on myself and like making sure I was okay. Cause I was a mess. Like I was constant freak out, like could not eat, could not sleep, could not talk to anybody without like freaking out and couldn't hold a conversation with anyone unless it was about that.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, so you have debilitating anxiety, a life-threatening medical situation, and your recovery is all on the line. It's like, you know, you can't take the anxiety medications that are quote-unquote recovery approved because they affect a separate health issue. But then if you don't treat the anxiety, that's going to make your current health issue that much worse. And then that's going to put your recovery on the line. Right. So what do you do?
Right.
But I think that's an important thing to mention is that, yeah, like you temporarily did, you know, do a naughty, like, you know, like people would consider what like a free lapse or whatnot, but it was like, you know, of everything that was on the table, what is the lesser of all of the evils?
Right.
And at that point, you know, it's like, okay, how can I safely take this medication that is a medication that is being prescribed, you know, and it's something that my intention is not to abuse, but to use as what it is for. And so it sounds like, you know, you put it in the care of another person.
Yep.
Like, this is when you give it to me. It's not I'm going to come ask you for it or I'm going to come get it. It's like,
no, you give it to me when you can tell, like, I need it.
Yeah.
Or when like my behaviors are, a lot of people were so nervous, rightfully so, watching me like a hawk every minute because, like, obviously the type, what my drug of choice is and, like, how my mental health has been in the past. Like, everyone thought either I was going to do relapse and kill myself or go kill myself, you know? So
no matter what,
I was going to die no matter what. And it was scary for them, you know? And so, like, even though, like, my mom, like, she knew that that's what I needed to do, and she's talking to my doctors. Like, my mom handled everything. I'm telling you, she was a superwoman the whole time because I don't know how to make a doctor's appointment at this point. I don't know how to talk to a doctor. I don't know what an oncologist is, you know? Like,
I mean, I don't know what an oncologist is.
Yeah, I mean, it's a cancer doctor, clearly, cool. You know? No, I just, but I was like, a what, you know? And the whole time was just terrifying for everybody, but, like, everyone around me had to realize it was most terrifying for me, you know?
Yeah.
And so they did what they had to do and they did, you know, what was best for me. And they did pretty good. Like, I knew they were watching every motion and everything I did. Mm-hmm. But I also knew that, like, they knew that they couldn't let me know, you know? Like, I obviously knew they were, but, like, they didn't want to make it obvious. And they did really good. They were – my family was a great support system throughout the whole thing. And my doctors, I have ran into doctors that were like, you're an addict. Like, why would we like give you that, you know? And then there's the ones that like, no, like I'm an addiction specialist. And I know like if you are going to therapy, which I always did, I still went to my relapse prevention group. I swear to you, I have more texts with my probation officer than I do everyone else because I wanted that accountability. Like, I didn't have to go into drug tests. I didn't have to like do community service like I was supposed to. Like, he let me pay my community service. Like, he made all these things for me. And I'm like, no, like, I'm going to be here at this time. Like, I wanted that accountability because I did not want to, one, I knew I couldn't go back to prison because who was going to give me chemo there? You know, who's going to make sure I was alive there? Nobody.
Yeah.
So I did everything I could in every situation in my life to make sure, like, I was staying on that right path, you know?
And what, like, where did that treatment kind of end up? Like, is this something, like, you're in remission from? Are you still being treated for this?
Okay, yeah. So on November 13th of 2024, I had the tumor removed. So right after, okay, so my birthday is February 20th. They call me, I'm diagnosed on February 29th. I had my PET scan and they saw it hadn't spread. It was stage 3. Which they said I was super lucky. It's a very fast, like rapidly growing tumor, like a type of cancer. It's very aggressive, very rare. They don't even have a stage 1. Like there is no stage 1 because of the level of aggressiveness that it is. By the first appointment I could get in with my oncologist, which was I got my port put in. We have to have a port for certain kinds of chemo. I have a double port, like on the 5th of March. And then the 8th, I met my oncologist. And then he was like, okay, like, we don't have time to wait for anything. Like, you're going to chemo Monday. And I stayed in the hospital during chemo. I did week-long, like, stays in the hospital to get my chemo because I was on 24-hour chemo the whole week. So, like, I could bring my Roku and everything and, like, my grandparents and my mom. Like, they could stay the night, whatever. Then I had to do radiation after that. I was supposed to do 6 rounds of chemo. That was supposed to take like 18 weeks. It took me way longer than that because like my body was just shutting down. Like I could not handle it. Everything in my body was completely depleted, no matter booster shots or transfusions they did. Like it was not coming back up. So then I got through that. I had to do like a break. I did radiation, did a break, and then they removed the tumor. So now, technically, when I talk to people, I call it remission because that's what everyone knows it as. Mm-hmm. But the kind of cancer I have doesn't have remission. So we have NED, which is no evidence of disease. But like I said, it's really hard to detect. It's really rare. Like, it's super aggressive. So they don't really call it remission. Like, I still have cancer, you know? It's just one of those things that, like, when I'm talking to someone, I'm like, just remission. It's just remission because it's easier than explaining it.
Right.
So what I do now is, like I did today, I have scans every 3 months. The first 3 months was a CT. The 6 month mark was a CT and an MRI. They're just getting different types of scans for different body parts based on what's best for it. This month was CT, which is like my head, chest, abdomen, and pelvis. Because the sarcomas love lungs. So, like, that's the riskiest place I have for a reoccurrence. I have, like, a really high possibility of reoccurrence, like 84%. But we're not going to think like that. So that's why they do those different kinds of scans. And most people will go down to, like, 6 months and then a year. I'll do 3 months all the way through. I think it's till the last year, then it's, like, a year. Like, I'll wait a year after that. Okay. And once you hit your 5-year mark, you're cancer-free.
Gotcha. And so throughout all of this, you've maintained your recovery, right? Mm-hmm. So now, all you listeners out there, no excuses. No, but that sounds like it's like a really scary thing to go through. And like at any point during this, are you thinking of picking something back up?
I think that I was more of, when I did think like that, it was like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I hated chemo, and I'm sure everyone who has ever gone through chemo understands what I'm saying right now. I wanted to die at all points. Like, I had a night where me and my mom, like, I would stay at her house on Sunday nights because we would wake up super early to drive me to the hospital, and I, like, wouldn't show up. Like, she was like, when are you going to be here? And I, like, went somewhere, and I came, and she was like, came outside and was like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm not going. I was like, I'm not going. I said, it's my body, my choice. I said, I'm not going. I'm done with chemo. She's like, you're not done with chemo. I said, then I'm going to go drive off the dam, like Lanier, you know? And she was like, grab the keys out of my hand.
We would never find you again.
I know. She grabbed the keys out of my hand and said, no, you're not. And I was like, I had a whole meltdown. And then I ended up going. But, you know, like, I had moments like that where I was like, in my head, like, this would be so much easier. But then I, like, honestly, like, my wife, like, was going through, like, prison at this time, and like she and I are so close, like I could not do that to her, you know, like my family too, obviously, you know, but like our connection in that time period was so, like, I felt like we were in this together. Like, everybody around us, like, was also going through it and they felt it too, but like our connection and the way we feel and the deep conversations we would have, like, I knew I just had to keep going, you know, like, I was scared of what would happen even if I, like, just gave up on chemo and then died from natural causes, you know. Yeah. Like, I wasn't willing to give up that, you know. I wasn't prepared to die. Like, even when you think like, oh, I've been suicidal and like I knew this and I knew that, I didn't want to die. And I knew that I had gone through prison that whole time knowing that like, I don't want to die as an addict. I don't want to die in a prison. Why would I want to get out and be living life and then die then too? Like, that's crazy. Like, I just decided to change my life.
Yeah.
So why would I give up now? You know?
Right.
That's crazy.
And so in these moments where you're like, you don't want to go to chemo and you're miserable every step of the way, like you, when you say like you wanted to die, but you weren't prepared to die. Was that like, when you say you wanted to, you wish that was something you didn't have to go through, but you still liked every other aspect of your life. Like, what did that really look like?
Yeah. I mean, I felt like it was really hard for me. It was mentally like, what is going on? Like, after all the years, like 6.5 years of incarceration, 10 years of addiction, like, why is this happening to me? Why is this happening to me right now? Mm-hmm. Like, I had gotten out. I immediately got a job. Like, I was happy. I was doing really good. Like, why now? You know? And some parts of me was like, oh, this is a punishment. Some parts of me, like, this is a lesson. But there were more parts of me that could not understand, what am I supposed to learn from this? Like, what good is this doing right now?
Right.
Because I felt like it was just mentally breaking me. And people would always be like, oh, you're so strong. And I hated that.
Oh, my God. That's the worst thing you could tell somebody.
I'm so strong, really, because, like, when all of y'all are off in y'all's little worlds because y'all don't want to talk about cancer because it makes you uncomfortable, I'm in my room crying, like, freaking out, like, because I don't know what's going to happen in my life.
Yeah.
Like, I have no idea if I'm ever going to have kids, if I'm ever going to have a future, if I'm going to have a job. And that wasn't fun for me, you know? And yes, I got through it, but I did not get through it by being this strong, like, I'm so positive and I can do it. Like, that is not how it went at all.
Right. And people are like, oh, you're so strong. Yeah. It's like, what's my alternative? Like, right. This is happening regardless. Yeah. So it's like, am I just gonna die? Yeah. Like, you know, yeah. And like in your situation, it's like that is what you were facing.
Mm-hmm.
And so through that, did that alter kind of how you approach your recovery?
Okay. So with what my job is now, so I got my CARES, the Certified Addiction Recovery Empowerment Specialist certification. And then I went on to get my Forensic Peer Mentor, CPS. Well, that CARES goes with CPS, Certified Peer Specialist in Addictive Disease. I had been planning to do all that before I got diagnosed. The week of my birthday that year was the class. So I knew that it was coming. I didn't apply. I had a lot of isolation time. I couldn't be around people. My immune system was completely, like, neutrophils at zero. Neutrophils is, like, the amount of immune system you have, kind of. I couldn't be out in public, so recovery was hard. Going to meetings was really hard. Being a part of a community and network was really hard, besides, like, over the phone.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, I was so tired all the time that I wasn't really doing that either. But I put a pause on getting my certifications because I was like, I don't think I can go and apply for something and then be told, oh, well, you have chemo that week, or, oh, you're too sick, or, oh, something's come up. I didn't want to be disappointed anymore. So I set myself up to not be disappointed. And a lot of people were like, oh, well, you're kind of like making excuses. Like, you could still like do this or you could still do that. And I'm like, no, like, I know myself. I know my limits. I don't want to do that. So I told myself, the day they tell me the cancer's out of my body, I will go and I will apply. So November 13th, 2024 was a Wednesday. I had surgery. I got home. My mom had gotten the report or whatever. Everything was clear. All the margins were good. And I opened my laptop and I went on the CARES website. And the next Monday was applications open. And it was the same week a year later, you know? And so I did apply. I got in. And I didn't think I got in at first, though, because they put my email wrong. So like everybody else had gotten in and I was like, I guess I didn't get in. I was like, that's kind of embarrassing. And then they called me like, hey, I think we like messed something up. Like, you haven't responded. And I'm like, I didn't get anything from you. Still to this day, that email does not get emails from them. I had to make a new one because I was not receiving emails from them for some reason. So that was really exciting. And I feel like at that point, brought all of what had happened the year before, like, to where, okay, it doesn't matter. Like, this is my goal. This is what I'm doing. And I've kind of just taken off from there. And there's still times that are, like, really hard for me. For, like, one every 3 months, I'm reminded that, hey, anything could happen, you know?
Right.
I hate it. The week before, I'm a total mess. Actually, I want to say this week, I really haven't been. This is the first scan that I've had that I've not been freaking out about.
I'm like, you seem to be, like, in really good spirits tonight. It does not.
Okay. So anybody who watched the intern takeover, I had just gotten a scan that day, but that was my MRI scan. So I'm medicated for that. I have to be, like, put to sleep, you know? And I literally was put to sleep, came out of that, and was driven here because I couldn't drive to get on the podcast.
Oh, my God. What is it? Okay, so anytime you're booked to be on the show.
I have, like, to have a scan. It has to every 3 months. Make it a point,
Christian. I'm going to be on camera. Hold on. Let me go to my oncologist.
Right. So, yeah. So that's really hard. That reminder every 3 months. And then there's the, okay, you have this doctor, this doctor, this doctor, and this doctor. They all want follow-ups. That is so annoying. You, four people sitting in the room for 2 minutes to tell you the exact same thing, and you have to take half a day off work just to do it. Like, you can't call me? They called me to tell me my results for my biopsy, you know, on my birthday. You know, you couldn't just, like, call me. So that's stressful, too, because it's like, God, like, I don't want to get fired from my job. Like, I don't want to have to, like, take off time, and none of the doctors are, like, close by. They're, like, down here, and I live all the way up in Dawsonville. So There's definitely still challenges, but for the most part, like, I've been, like, reaching my goals. Everything that I've been wanting to do that whole year that I sat and thought about, that I made a plan, like, this is what I want my life to look like, is coming true, you know?
Okay, so
Care 69.
So
I would say if it, my grandma's watching.
Oh, my gosh. We have former interns in the audience, and they are derailing the show.
He's also my CARES cohort. Shout out, Chad.
So we have, you're in recovery. It's your birthday was when you, was that when you got the diagnosis, or yeah, when you went to the hospital?
No, that's the January 11th was when I went to the hospital. So okay. February 20th is my official diagnosis day.
Okay, so you're in recovery, you get cancer-free birthday, and then you go through a whole bunch of chemo that makes you super sick, and you do the best you can, but then you go through CARES after, when you're, like, no longer bedridden, essentially, mm-hmm, and doing the damn thing. And you've been to prison, and you've been to county jails, and you've done RSAT, and you've done this, that, and the other. So really what I'm hearing is, as far as, like, peer support goes, there's not really a peer, and you're gay. Like, there's not.
Yeah.
There's not a peer you can't help.
No, I am.
You mentioned and your wife. And I'm only 25. I'm like, I'm not outing you. You mentioned your wife.
Yeah, no. I'm very open about my wife. I love her.
But, you really do.
Yeah, I really love her. Watch the last one. I shouted her out at the end. You know? But, and I'm only 25, so I really can still, like, with the CPSY, which is the youth, you know, I still fit in that category.
Yeah, so, I mean, I can't think of, like, a better suited person to be peer facing, right? Because it's like, it sounds like out of, like, everything that life has thrown your way, everything that you've thrown your way, you know, it's like, you've been there and you can be there. And so how has that peer support journey looked for you since, what, do you graduate from CARES? Or do you just finish it?
I mean, you take a test. Okay, so you take a test and do, like, a graduation for CARES. Like, we went up and read our elevator speech, which is kind of like a, if you were to run into somebody who, like, could make a difference in this world, and you have 2 minutes to tell them why they should, you know, listen to you, and why you are, like, have the credentials to even be telling these people anything, mm-hmm, what would you say, you know? So we got to do our speeches. Of course, mine was on prison reform. And
you're like, I've been to all of them. They suck.
Yeah. Help the people. And then you kind of have like a graduation, you walk in, get your diploma. The CPS AD, which is like follows that, it's connected. You, that's what you actually take the test for, and they mail your certificate. And then Forensic Peer Mentor, we had like a graduation with our elevator speech that like Christian and Caleb and Liam, they all got to like watch on video. Oh, yeah, Chad was there too. Got to watch on like video and stuff. So that was like a little graduation.
Okay. So since graduation, how has that peer support been?
So I was working here at Most High Media after CARES. I met Chad, he was an intern here. And he told me, I was like, hey, I really want to be on that podcast that, you know, I see your fiance posting about. And he was like, why don't you apply, you know? And so I applied here. I was working here. And Christian allowed me off to do my forensic peer mentor training and everything and get my certification. And an opportunity arose that was like my dream job in the jail that I literally grew up in with every...
Not the jail you grew up in.
The jail I grew up in.
Girl, what in the white trash hell?
Well, it is, you know, Forsyth County. No, she is.
God bless.
Yeah, I mean, like, literally, like, they always arrested me. I was on probation there forever. They just love me so much.
Well, they
won't.
Like, yeah, they don't. They lovers.
Yeah, they don't want to get rid of me. You know, it's really funny,
Jesus
actually.
Christ.
And they only interviewed me. Like when they said after I told them my story and everything, they're like, "We need you." And like, it took a really long time because it's through the DBHDD, which is the Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Disabilities, and I'm still on probation, so I had to do a lot to be able to be approved for that position. And I feel like the satisfaction I feel from the fact that I was and like was taken a chance on, you know, is really amazing because like I had to get references. I had to write like a life story. I had to like put a lot into being able to get the job. And it was really hard on me because I love this job and I love the people here and I wasn't done with my internship. So it was a lot of conversations with me and Christian and me and David and Brian was here at the time. And it was like a whole mental battle because like, this is what I love, but that's what like my future, that's what I want so bad. And so I started on July 1st and had to go through training. And so now I'm working like for Avita, I'm with the jail inReach program. So I haven't gotten to go in the jail yet, but I've been meeting with community members and stuff and being able to like tell them who I am, what I'm doing. And people love that. Like, and obviously I live in the recovery community. So everyone of course loves peer specialists because, you know, it's our stories, you know, but I'm talking to people like on the Board of Education, like in the Sheriff's Department, like people in the community that have nothing to do with, you know, the recovery community at all. And they all love that idea. And it's so cool to like have them come up to me and be like, hey, like I have this situation and, you know, I don't really know what to do, but like, do you know what we could do to fix this? And like, they're trying to work together and make it better for everybody, you know? So I love that even normies are like getting on the bandwagon and like realizing what the power of a personal story to someone who you've been through it, you know what they're going through and why we can help you, you know?
Right. I mean, you know, personal stories, that's why you have influencer marketing, for right. God's sake. So it's like, yeah, recovery is kind of the same thing where it's like, you know, you need to have that representation of, you know, not only like as the person who needs recovery, looking at a person in recovery, being like, okay, if they can do it, I can do it. But as someone, you know, like a normie, someone looking at someone who's in recovery, they didn't see our past, right? So it's just like, oh, this is just like a normal person. And it's like, huh, you thought, like, wait till you hear everything else. And so then it kind of, I don't know, because I'm not a normie, so I don't get how they think, but it seems that that it's like when they can see what we're like today and know of what we used to be like, then they're like, okay, wait, maybe they know what to do in certain situations.
Yeah.
And you're just the professional version of that.
Yeah. And I'm telling you, I don't hold back when I'm talking to somebody. Like if they ask, I'm going to tell them the truth. You know, I was crazy. I was an addict. Like I went through it and everything that you judge on someone who's sitting in jail, I probably did it. And
you're like, yeah, I grew up in jail.
Yeah. Like, yeah, for real. No, I'm only 25, y'all. I've been out almost 2 years and I did 6.5 if y'all want to do the math. So pretty much their jaw doesn't drop when I have to explain why I know something about, like, why this needs to happen because of this, and I have to explain a part of my life, they don't, they're not like, oh, you know, they're like, oh my God, wow, okay, cool, so this is what we can do. And, but, you know, they're listening, and, like, I'm kind of that person that wants to change the world, and I know that it's not, I can't just, like, do it overnight, so it's going to take, like, connecting with those people who have the power to make things happen and making them understand why it needs to happen.
Right. And what has been, like, so far, what has been the most rewarding part of doing peer support work?
So, like I said, I haven't really gotten into the jail yet, but I've done a lot of, like, peer support work without it being an official paid job of any sort, like just helping people that I've known from prison or that I've known that have people that I know of the people that I know. And like doing some people, most people are sitting in prison right now with the smallest paperwork issue. I'm talking about the smallest thing. And like, they don't have someone who understands what they're going through or is able to like navigate the situation. Their families don't know how to call the parole board or how to talk to the parole board to ask the right questions. And so like I help people with that all the time. Like literally there was just somebody the other day who they were sitting in there and they had their TPM, which is like their release date kind of, but they weren't setting like the actual release date that the day they got out. And I called the county and all it was nobody had signed off that they said they didn't want to go pick them up. They sat in there for 2 months extra for no reason.
Oh, wow.
You know? Or there's, like, the people who they don't know how to talk to someone else, you know? Therapists don't work for them. 12 steps don't work for them, you know? And for some reason, people just kind of talk to me without it, like, being asked or anything. People just feel comfortable around me. And I've been able to talk to people who, like, refuse to talk to anybody else, you know? And I love that. I love that people feel safe with me. I love that people, you know, want to come up to me and ask me things and that it works. They, like, I'm able to get through to them when nobody else was, like, because they might not ever have had somebody like that if I wasn't around, you know? If I was still on drugs, I mean, like I said in the other podcast, I probably would have asked them if they wanted to go to rehab. But, you know, like, for real, now they can see, like, I'm not just some crazy hypocrite getting high, you know, like I'm really doing it. Like it's really possible. And I love that. I love that I can show people like it is possible and we do recover, you know?
And what exactly is a forensic peer support specialist?
So that's somebody who's been through the justice system, the criminal justice system. That could look anything like you spent a night in jail for a DUI. You've been on probation or you did 20 years in prison. They don't really discriminate against that. You know, if you have had any justice system involvement, you can become one. Now, of course, there you probably want to have some kind of knowledge in whatever field you're going into. Like, I would love to work in the prisons one day, you know? There's a lot of stuff going on in the prisons that they need people, you know, and they need someone who can listen because there's not anybody who wants to listen. And if you've never been to prison, you probably shouldn't be a forensic peer mentor in a prison. If you've never been, the DBHDD has a, what is it called? The youth, RYDC, like the.
Can't help you there, dog.
Well, thank you. Juvenile justice. They have like people who go in there. If you've never been to like RYDC is any type of juvie, you probably aren't going to be a forensic peer mentor there, you know? So it's still based on what your experience is because how you're going to give your lived experience about something if you didn't do it.
Right. And that's like something like you hear a lot when people don't trust therapists and they don't trust doctors and they don't trust whoever, you know, who's meant to help. Cause it's like, you haven't been where I am. So how do you even have the credentials to know what I'm going through? Cause you can't, you can read about symptoms, you can read about experiences, but until you've shared them, until you've lived with them, it's such like, it's such a common thing of you don't understand me.
Right.
And that's where, like, at least that's my understanding of peer support is like, no, like these are the people who understand you.
Yeah.
And that is a really good point. So it's like, if you haven't gone through juvie, that you probably wouldn't be beneficial in that scenario. If you haven't been in prison, you probably wouldn't be beneficial in that situation, you know? But, I mean, I think that's great too, that there's all these different aspects of recovery and all these different roads that you can take it into based off of the specific unique experiences you've had in your own journey and story and use that not only for the good of the community immediately around you, but for people who are, you know, in more dire situations and have less access to, you know, a larger community,
right,
like people who are incarcerated. Mm-hmm. And so with that, is it like, is it counseling? Is it talking? Like, what does that look like?
So technically it's mentoring. Now I've called a counselor a lot. I don't think I'm technically a counselor. I'm pretty sure I'm not, but that's what they call me a lot of the times. But it's kind of like mentorship. So like, to an extent, we'll sit and talk, and whatever you want to talk about, we can talk about, you know. If you want to know something about me to like help you understand why I can help you, then like I'm allowed to share that. A lot of, you know, therapists can't share parts of their lives, you know, like,
yeah, the like, bad ones can't. Yeah.
You know, like, it's just like there's like rules on certain like jobs and like what you can say and what they can know about,
right,
you.
Like teachers.
Right. Teachers. Yeah. You know, there's some places you're not even allowed to know their first names, you know, and like officers, you know, most of the time that's hidden information. And like in a CO in a jail, you don't know anything but their last name. Mm-hmm. So I can talk to them about pretty much anything as long as it's like ethical. And then I also can help them with resources. So if they need help with something and they ask for that help, and you know, I'm not going to push it on them. I'm not going to force them into it. But if that's what they want and like they feel like that's what they need for their recovery, like I can help them find rehabs. I can help them find housing. I can help them find, you know, or sign up for food stamps, or, you know, like I can guide them and all that stuff, or I can connect them to someone who can better do that. And, that's kind of what I've been doing the last couple of weeks, like getting into my role and everything, is like creating resource lists and connecting with people, finding community resources that we didn't know about, like connecting and finding out what each place does and who they best serve, so that when I have somebody and they say, hey, you know, I don't really need rehab, but like a treatment center, but I really could use a sober living, then I know like, okay, this is, you know, where I could send them, or mm-hmm. these are places that are easy to get in contact with or better for them. Like I've been like studying each type of facility that's in Georgia, not just in the county I'm in, but around, just to know what best fits somebody. And that's just because while I can talk to them and we can, you know, do things, I can also get other certifications that I'm planning on getting, like, RAP and WAM, which don't ask me what they mean right now because I'm really bad with the acronyms. I'm still learning. But
there's also, only so many of them.
Yeah. I mean, I can also like my friends at Peer Mentor gave me a journal. It was like, hey, journal, you know? And if I wanted her to go over it with me and like get those things out of my head, we would. But if not, like it was just my journal, you know? And that ability to just do what I felt, taking control of my own life for the first time. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm sober, I'm not in jail or prison, and I get to decide what's good for me without having somebody tell me what's good for me, helped me a lot, because that's what I wanted. Like, I know what I want, and I don't always know how to do it, though. Mm-hmm. So having that guidance and knowing that I always had someone there, that if I needed them, they would be there. But I still was able to make my decisions and find what I was comfortable with in my life. That's what helped me.
Okay. And I think that's like really important that's now an official role that people are able to have. Like, it sounds like the peer support you had was very crucial for your recovery.
Yeah.
And it sounds like what you're able to offer for other people will be crucial for them as well. Cause I know, like, a conversation I've had with my sister-in-law 1,000 times, my sister-in-law, she works in law enforcement. She works in probation. Like, I always had the notion that probation officers were kind of like the liaison between being, you know, incarcerated or being not incarcerated. Mm-hmm. And that is not true. You know, like, the probation officer is literally just a record keeper. Like, are you doing the community service you're supposed to do? Are you doing the drug test you're supposed to do? Like, are you literally like following out the sentence that the judge gave you?
Right.
Whereas my understanding, because of how I've seen people interact with their probation officers, or like want to know from their probation officers, is like, hey, like, I'm a felon. How do I find housing? They can't help you.
Yeah.
Like, oh, like, I need, you know, like, I need this type of help. Where can I go? They can't help you. Like, they may have that knowledge, you know, personally, they may know of places they can do, but legally, they cannot give that information to you.
I actually really love, like, what the county that I'm working in, the probation office is working really, like, closely with ours. Like, they refer everybody to us. Like, if they're having that issue, if we have just in where I work, we have like a job specialist that helps you get jobs, that felon friendly jobs or good for people who have mental health disorders that like really, really need like a specific kind of job, even ones that have like the SSI, but they still want to work a little bit, you know, that jobs that fit that. We have somebody who handles housing. We have somebody who, you know, does kind of all of the things, and they are learning their, you know, people, and they're sending them to us if they need that kind of service and stuff. So it's pretty cool to like be working together to make it better for everybody.
And what would you say to somebody who's like considering, you know, maybe just peer support, maybe forensic peer mentor, like all of these, any of these acronyms that you've been mentioning, you know, if somebody is thinking like, that sounds interesting, maybe they want to explore that. What would you suggest that they do?
Well, the first thing I would suggest is, one, you have to either get your CARES and CPSAD or your CPS and mental health before you can go on to forensic peer mentor. Like, that is a second step. You have to have that first. That you can go to either the Georgia Mental Health Consumer Network, or you can go to the Georgia Council for Recovery websites and find like the different dates for the cohorts or the classes and stuff, and to get certified. The next thing I would say is, it's really hard to take care of people's emotions and like handle that if you're not taking care of yourself. So I'm still working on this really hard, but self-care is so big because we are in recovery. So a lot of us have a lot of empathy and we understand what they're going through. So it hurts so bad. We cannot fix these people. Right. We do not fix. If they go down a bad path or if they overdose, that is not our fault.
Right.
We cannot force them, and whatever decision they make is not on us. So it's really hard because that doesn't always matter, even if we know that. You have to take care of yourself, you know. Yeah. I still have a therapist. I still, you know, talk to my people, still have my network, still have to do everything I have to do every day because I cannot let myself fall down. How am I going to help people if I can't, if I'm gone, you know, like, can't do that.
Right.
So, that's a really, really big thing, but I would definitely suggest it because we need more. They need more so bad. If you have been through it and you are willing to do what it takes to be that, like, they always need more. And there's so many places that are finally like understanding that. So positions are opening all the time. And like, Georgia is really like starting to become a recovery state, you know?
Oh, that's awesome. Because you still go anywhere. Anywhere there's a suburb with a trailer park, there's always, like, the methadone clinics and, like, the Suboxone. Just, like, in the little yard signs literally everywhere. It's like, wow, maybe there's a drug problem here. Well, that's great to know that, that recovery is becoming a little more widespread around here. And what about for the person who's facing, like, the really life-threatening news in their recovery?
It's never going to be easy. It's never going to be fun. And you're going to have those thoughts a lot. Even if things are going well, you're still going to just have like that. The old you is going to try to resurface. Just don't let it. Just talk to your people. And not everybody has like a family that's super supportive or a friend group that's super supportive. And not everyone's recovery community is as strong or network is as strong as it needs to be. But there are, okay, social workers in a hospital, they have a lot of resources to a lot of really good groups. And
you're like super passionate right now.
Oh, yeah.
Like, these social workers.
No, they're actually, a lot of people don't know that, like, a social, if you ask for a social worker in a hospital, they'll just come in and be like, yeah, here, there's this, there's this, there's this, there's this. And, like, they're there to help you, you know? And a lot of hospitals now are having CPS as well. So if you just tell them, maybe what we need to do is have, like, a new CPS for, like, what is the word? What was when you're gonna like, terminal illnesses, you know, like CPS terminal illness, you know? But there's definitely things out there. There's also like online meetings and there's, you know, things that you can do, but like, just keep fighting, like, because nobody knows what the future is. When we were in addiction, we didn't know if we were going to live or die. If you're going through cancer or any other, you know, disease that you have no control over, we don't know what's going to happen, you know, but we still can keep fighting. And once you do get through it, you know, that feeling is so great. Like, I felt so much better when it was over, you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I think that everybody should be positive, even when it's really hard, you know? And you can do
you
it.
You just went from, yeah. I'm not that person who was, like, yeah. strong because I was super positive to, you know what? Everyone no, should be positive.
No. Okay. Okay, y'all. I am now really positive. I'm normal. The normal Bailey is so positive. No, I struggled really bad. That, but y'all should be positive. God. Didn't I tell y'all I was a hypocrite?
You did.
I did. Wow, I did.
It came to fruition.
Ignore me. What happened? No.
No, thank you so much for just coming out and joining us tonight to really, like, there's a lot of experience, strength, and hope, you know?
Yes. let God. Wait, we can't talk?
No. Oh, that's... Oh.
Well, technical difficulties.
I can't ignore you, Katie. I'm sorry. I feel like I just, like, need to give her in the camera a moment. They need their privacy.
Well,
but
yeah. I said let God because I have a tattoo of let go, let God on my chest, and somebody messed it up and it said let God. So that's why I just said that, if anybody was wondering.
Let God.
It doesn't say it anymore. I ripped the ink out, like, as soon as, like, I literally uh-huh. scraped the ink out for days, and then I got a tattoo to cover the D.
Wow. Yeah, so if you're going through something, Bailey's probably also done it.
Don't get a tattoo.
Including scratching out your own tattoos. anyway, but yeah, it's definitely, I mean, achieving goals against all odds is, you know, exactly what you've done. You know, you've faced all sorts of curveballs throughout your life, and especially within your recovery, but you're still out here doing the damn thing. And it's really inspirational, and it's an honor to know you.
I love you.
And I'm so grateful for the opportunity to have had to, been able to sit down and have this conversation with you.
Yes.
Is there any final thoughts before we close out?
Just keep fighting, y'all. Y'all got it.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you to our in-studio audience tonight for joining us and keeping us company. And thank you to Katie on the ones and twos producing this whole thing tonight. And thank you to our donors and supporters who make this show possible.
And Christian for texting me asking me to be on the show.
And this has been another episode of The Most High Show.
Woo!